Okay. In college, I would go during the summer to work in Colorado. We had family that was up there, and so there was this bed and breakfast where I would go in Estes Park, Colorado, most of the summers that I was in college, and go to work there. It was an awesome place to work. There's tons, like, this great mixture of people. So there were, like, townies who would kind of come up to the inn, and it was also a restaurant. And then there were a lot of college kids that would come to live there. And it was the most, like, idyllic situation of all time, like, maybe of my life. So, and it was up on the, it was outside of town, like, up on the mountain. They had cabins for us to live in, like, behind this, like, old historic inn. And it was this great mixture of people who were, like, adventurous and kind and just really fun. And there were so many people that, like, anytime you wanted to do anything, if you wanted to go to the porch to read a book, there was somebody who was available to go do that with you. If you wanted to go into town and, like, go shopping or whatever, there was somebody who was ready to, like, go with you. It was this great community of people. We were all around the same age and kind of had, like, really similar interests. If you wanted to go hiking, somebody could go with you to go do that. It was just like a family. It was really comfortable. There's always sort of like weirdos in the mix too, but that was like part of the fun. And it was just a really safe place. I had been there like many, many years. I love the owner. She was this really kooky woman who would stay up all night and make pies. And so we would like go out for the like our evening whatever in town, and we'd come home at you know midnight or one or something, and then we would sit up and like talk with her in the kitchen as she would kind of like make her pies and things. And so we had this mother figure, and it was really just a great experience for me. If you've seen Dirty Dancing, do you know where they work, Kellerman's or whatever? I've always told people it was a lot like Kellerman's, except, like, nobody got pregnant, that I know of. So anyway, like, after May, when I graduated from college, I went back for this one last summer, and I decided to take my childhood best friend for, like, 20 years or so went with me, and my sister went with me that summer, and it was awesome. They fit right in. We took road trips together. We shared cars and clothes and everything. It was just this really perfect situation. And I say all this to really emphasize, because a lot of what our passage deals with this week is this contrast. Because this was this really safe community that I was in with tons of fellowship. And I went from that. That fall, I moved to Honduras to teach English there. And so I went from having like this great family of people to being like completely isolated and like not even having the language skills to be able to like try to attempt to make those connections with people. And something that I always felt like was like I was really agile with language, and then to have like to be like at such a loss, I just couldn't even make it happen. And I remember like stepping off of the plane, and it happened like so quickly. I stepped off the plane, and my headmistress at the school where I was going to work was there. And she took me to her house, which was very Honduran. And so she was a single mom, and she lived with her parents. And it was, you know, like a fine house, but like concrete floors and sort of like bare bulbs, you know, that kind of thing. And the only person in the house who spoke English was her 8-year-old daughter. And I was like, what did I do? Like, I've made a huge mistake. And so I just like, and she was so kind to me and tried to like feed me and dry my tears, but I just was like, I'm just going to go like in here for a while. And I said, like, give me all the books, and I'm going to be in the books for like a few weeks. And I'm not coming out. And eventually like they got me a house with an English speaking roommate who was totally crazy. And like not in a good way, and we ended up like clashing the entire year that I was there, and it was mostly my fault. I was really messy, and she was not having part of that, and so we had nothing in common. The only thing we had in common is we liked to lay on the beach, and we did not like tarantulas in the house, and that was it. And other than that, like, it was just really tense living with her. And so that it was just so hard. And it was the first time in my life where I was like, oh, like life does not always like go my way kind of stuff. And I felt really like at a loss and really weak and super lonely in a way that I had never felt before in my life. And so it definitely felt like an exile, this like very humid kind of solitary confinement. And so And even in the town, like, there was nobody in town who was really my age. If they were my age, they were either away at university or they had babies and they weren't available to hang out and stuff. And so I found myself doing, like, really kind of kooky stuff, just, like, hanging out with strangers and, like, sitting with the old men who would be in the bars and things like this because I didn't have anybody. Like, I was so desperate. But I did get to, and I didn't get to go home for Thanksgiving, which was really heartbreaking and pathetic. But I did get to go home for Christmas, and I went home, and it was like, I'm coming back to the promised land of East Texas, and my family was there, and all my friends, everybody had just graduated from college, all the friends were back home, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is so sweet, and we just got into this rhythm, and I got to, like, wear sweaters and things, and, but then, you know, like, I knew that I had to leave it, and leaving it the second time, like, without the novelty of this experience and without my, like, naivete, was worse. And I think that in a lot of ways that's kind of where we are in Hosea, is that they have been in exile in Egypt before. They got taken to the promised land and they were having to go back. And so not all of this is exactly like a parallel, but that some of that is. And my parents, you know, they couldn't make me go back. But there was, like, this sense, like, this is good for you. You have made a commitment. You need to follow through on this kind of thing. And so this push, and I think in some ways, like, the same with Yahweh, like, not exactly the same, but in some ways with Yahweh, like, this is for your good to go back, even though this is very painful. And when I went back, it was just terrible. And I was, like, over it. I was, like, these beautiful mountains, this beautiful beach, you know, and my house was like two blocks from the beach. You could hear the waves, but I was just done with, all of it. I didn't have a car. And so the men, when you would walk around like by yourself, they would make like this hissing noise at you. And they would go like, not like this, this is an A&M thing, but they would hiss at you. And like, it was so like threatening. And part of this was like, oh, in the States, like I can do all, like I have a lot of safety to kind of be independent, and I did not have that when I was there. And so I did all these things to like cope with that, but I was really glad, like when it was time to come home, I felt so glad about that. But I want us to see through all that, like this big contrast between exile and home, and how those things are different. And I want us to see like this sort of shifting back and forth between those things is such a biblical idea. Like we see that motif not just in Hosea, which is what we'll focus in on here in a second, but like the Bible, like the whole thing is about that. And I think that's really interesting to think about, like, what about God that tells us something about his character, and especially about the way that he writes his story. And so we see that, like, Adam and Eve being in the garden and then being taken out of the garden. We see that with Jacob and Esau and the way that their birthright is flipped. God loves to, like, take these things and reverse them, to flip what we think should be and to turn it on its head. David's wilderness and haven kind of wandering throughout his story. Even in the Psalms, this alternating, like, grief and joy in the Psalms. Like, there's something about the human condition. There's something about God himself that that this rhythm, like, illustrates. Even Brian on Sunday was talking about this idea of having an upside down king. That speaks to this also. The idea that blessed are you when people revile you, that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I mean, like the whole Bible is speaking this, something about this message. The idea of like loving your enemies, and the biggest example, like Christ himself, that he died and then rose again. Like that is so contrary to what we think should happen. And so let's kind of burrow into Hosea. And I want to, this passage was just all over the map. And I get really frustrated when I can't organize it. Like these verses are about this. These verses are about this. And so I just apologize because I feel like the message is more like topical is how it's kind of thinking about it and not like so linear straight through the passage. And so we're kind of talking about the language of this whole thing. But there are, like, even in the way that he's talking, and I don't want to, like, bore you with all of this, but I think we should note that, like, as he's speaking, like, up to this point, it's mostly been, like, him using the voice of Yahweh. So he's speaking for Yahweh, as Yahweh. And here he kind of gets, like, bobbles that a little bit. And so he goes from talking about himself as the prophet to then using the first person sort of my. And so we have him sort of, like, this reversal, even in like the language itself. Also in the audience, the way he's talking about the Israelites, he goes from talking about them like as a second person you to a third person sort of they them, and even this is this back and forth like mixed up kind of thing. And this is not a criticism against the book, because I think that this is done, like this is something to note about Hosea and something to note about Yahweh himself, is that this is not logical, this is not systematic theology, this is not like logical linear stuff. And the thing that we should take away from that is that he is very emotional. Hosea is very emotional about it. Yahweh is very emotional about it. And it would be horrible if he was not. Like, that would be so robotic and soulless and passionless, okay? We like that he is so, like, upset about this. Because it's not a chart. It is a raging fight between a husband and a wife. And I know that none of you are familiar with that, but I am an expert on that. And fights in the bedroom have mixed metaphors, and they do not sort of say point A, ergo point B, ergo like our logical conclusion. They are mixed up, and it's these like pivoting trains of thought and like short outbursts in this sort of like Tourette's kind of like language. And so we see that definitely happening here with this. And so this kind of like emotional charge is part of the difficulty of the book, because we want to sort of find the path of it. And I think it's really, that's really elusive here. But these kind of, this like frenzy or like cyclical thing that's happening in the language is really helpful for us to take away and sort of understand about the passion that is in the message. That this idea that Yahweh can be hurt, that he is jealous, that he cares very much about what is going on. Like, that's the takeaway. All right, so let's kind of pivot now into kind of our setting, because I think it's really helpful to know for this passage that this is probably happening around the autumn festival. And so Hosea is kind of looking out. They've just brought in the harvest, and he's looking out because there's all this mention of, like, threshing floors and the wine fats and all this kind of thing. Because what it sounds like, is that Hosea's kind of having, like, this shower argument with himself, where he's, like, speaking, then they would say this, and then I would come back and say this kind of thing with the people of Israel. And so what's happening here is when we start out, like, they're looking out at the threshing floor and saying, look at this harvest that we have. Like, all of our prayers to Baal have paid off. We have this huge bounty that's happening all around us. So, like, what are you talking about, Hosea? All this, like, doom and gloom doesn't make sense when we have been so blessed. You know, and he calls this bountiful harvest their prostitutes' wages in verse 1, that they bought the bounty with their, like, unfaithfulness to Baal. And you see this, like, very visible sign of what has been going on that they take as a positive thing, as a thing of security, and he's saying, oh, no. And he also gets into that, like, you have this, but this, all this bounty that you have is not filling the whole, it's not, like, it's not going to satisfy you. It's not what you really need. And beyond that, even, like, it's going to end. And it's not because the harvest is going to go bad or the crops are going to fail. It's not that the crops won't be there. It's that you will not be there. You have the switch between, like, what the Israelites should be, what they do love and what they hate, and that those things should be reversed. He talks about that you love the prostitute's wages. And then later on in the passage, he talks about, but you hate the prophet. And so we have this reversal of how things should be. And later in the passage, they, like, spew, this is kind of in his, you know, voice for them, but they're calling him a fool, a crazy man, and maybe if we knew Hosea, we might think that too. But his sort of verse 8 is this refutation of that. It's this parley that I'm doing my job. The prophet should be a watchman, and I am watching out for you. All this is for you. And then I think, and so I'm going to start on kind of our big, like, push, like, this big chunk of topic up at the top. And this is that idea in verses 1 through 4 of their shifting sustenance, like, where they're finding their satisfaction from. And so they're trying to find this kind of temporary, merely physical means of sustenance, okay? We talked about the harvest. And so in verses 1 through 2, they're talking about the threshing floor and the wine vats. And he's saying, these things don't feed you. They are going to fail you. In verse 3, he talks about you're going to eat unclean food in Assyria. So you're eating the wrong thing in the wrong place. Again, we have flipped these, what should be. It talks about in verse 4 that they're not pouring out the drink offerings as they should be. And I inserted a chart right there. This is not to like stop down on this chart and to talk about the offerings, but I think that it's helpful. I'm not going to read this, but I just want you to see like those columns. There are 5 main offerings. So the burnt offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, peace offering, and grain offering. And that's just sort of as an aside. Sometimes I think like this idea, some of these ideas, we just kind of throw them out there and assume that kind of everybody knows what we're talking about. And there'll be another chart about the covenants here in a second. And I think it's helpful just to have a very simple kind of like framework. This is kind of what we're talking about with Old Testament sacrifices and offerings. And then in verse 4, they talk about you're going to be defiled by the mourner's bread. And the mourner's bread would be what they would eat of the sacrifice, but it would render those who ate it unclean. And so this was not, it's not a good thing. And so obviously we, like the Israelites, are attempting to fill, I mean, every day, every moment, attempting to fill this deeper hunger with merely physical substitutes. And we know that this stuff is not satisfying. And we've talked about this, I feel like, probably all semester in your small groups. We are craving this distractions. We're craving treats, all different kinds. And maybe that's a literal treat, but a lot of times it's a lot of different things. Because we're looking for the security and the fulfillment in these wrong places. And Hosea's audience, so much like us, has this abundance. I mean, we can look around our congregation and see the bags that people carry and see the cars that people drive. And like clearly, like just living in America by itself, like that is enough abundance compared to the rest of the world. But like looking even within Fort Worth to look around our congregation and let's be really honest about what our position is. And like we're at such danger, like our, I don't know if our biggest danger, but such danger to find our security in that stuff. And in like the perfection that we have the means to really almost achieve. Like so many different things. If I could have the perfect life, if I could have the perfect kids, if I could have the perfect body, if I can have the perfect lecture, if I can have the perfect philanthropy, if I can have the perfect resume, like on and on and on. Like these are the things that I want, and this is going to like patch me up to make me like put this position out there. And I would never say, you know, like even in our like conscious minds, we would never say, oh, that's where I'm finding my security. You know, like we're good Christian. We're church ladies, man. We're not going to say that. But, like, where do I go crawling, you know, when it's hard? What is my first face that I want to show you? What is, like, what is my whole heart? What's underneath my heart? And it gets, like, that's where it gets really sticky. And the things that I don't even, like, really think about. And we know, and I want to, like, just say it again and say it again, like, you know it's not going to sustain, and you know it's not going to save you. And so when we're thinking in terms of, like, our sustenance, so what are these cravings? You know, how much of my time and my thoughts do I waste on these, like, thirsts for other things? Things that may be mistimed or unnecessary or even, like, straight up forbidden. What are these things? And what, like am I, and I have good, you know, like I have good things, right things, and like my appetites turn to dwell on the stuff that I don't need, you know, and I want to nip those thoughts in the bud, you know, like I want to stop it, but I find that I have these ruts in my thinking that it's just really hard to like jump out of that a lot of times. And so I want to be, like, distracted by stuff over there, not, like, what I have a lot of times. And so, I mean, this goes, you know, the list goes on and on. What's the neighborhood I want to live in, the school I want my kids to go to? If I only got, like, invited to that thing, if my kids, you know, if my kid was not a strong-willed child, then my life would be so right, so easy. If I had more adventure in my life, less chaos in my life, if I was more outgoing or more tactful or anything, you know, just a million different things. And it comes in through cracks that are about, like, my bad choices, but it also comes in through things that we had no control over, things that happened to us, too. So what do we do? We know that these things don't feed us. How do I stop, like, these appetites? And it's not just by denial and discipline, although I do think sometimes that plays into it. But I think that it's, like, enjoying something better. It's not only criticizing the counterfeit gods, but it's fixing our eyes on the true God. And I think that this plays into what Kira talked about last week, too, this idea of remembering. What are we remembering? And the old answers are good answers, you know, to abide in his word, by prayer, by obedience to his commands. And those are very hard things a lot of times. And so these verses 1-4, are centering so much around this unsatisfying bread and wine and things gone wrong. And it's like this is a clear contrast to communion and to feasting on like the good things and who he is, that he's the bread of life, that he's the wine poured out. They point to this filling feast and the supper of the Lamb. Do y'all do a common cup? Sometimes, and maybe it's not awkward for you, but sometimes it is awkward, and you're, like, reaching forward, and they're feeding you, and it's this really, like, passive kind of thing for somebody to, like, give you a drink, and then even, like, to come up, you know, like, with your little hands outstretched, you know, give me my little taste, and it takes, like, what he says in verse 5, well, what will you do on the day of the appointed festival and on the day of the feast of the Lord, and it just totally breaks that. Because communion is what we do. It takes his sort of ironic and cynical tone, and all of the power drains out of that when we are able to come forward and take that feast in communion. And I like dining in fine dining places. It is absolutely my favorite thing to do. I like to get dressed. I like to go. And sometimes at a really fun, like, fine dining restaurant, they give you something called an amuse-bouche. Have you heard of this? And it's just a little bite. And so you kind of, like, put your coat down, put your purse down, gotten your menu, you have your napkin in your lap, and you maybe have gotten your cocktail, and you're waiting, and they sometimes will bring you, like, just a bite. And it's always, like, this show-stopping bite. It's really beautiful. It's really tasty. But it doesn't satisfy you. You know, it's just one bite. It's not going to fill you up. It's not enough. It's just a nibble. It's just a taste. But it does signal what the feast is going to be about. It tells you, like, this is the style of the chef. This is what you're about to experience, like the full experience of it. And so communion, I think, is a lot like that amuse-bouche, which means, like, to amuse the mouth or to tease the tongue. And so communion in some ways is like this this tease. It's this taste of this feast that we have coming. And so we do have, like, this family meal that, I mean, even the word itself, communion, that is binding us together, and it's pointing backwards toward, like, the slaughter that had to happen to put the meat on the table, basically. And it's pointing forward towards that supper of the Lamb that we're looking forward to, where he prepares the feast. And I think that's really beautiful. All right, and so let's push into, and again, this is not linear, but sort of topical, but let's shift over to the reversal or the flip that happens between, like, geographically, what he's talking about, between Exodus and exile. And so we have this contrast between the promised land and then the sort of punishment land. And he gives you sort of, he lists off these different places. So he's talking about Egypt, he talks about Assyria, and he talks about Memphis. And I have that little chart right there of kind of the, not kind of the covenants. And so this idea of promised land is a big deal, and it's a long time coming. And so you see that first in the Abrahamic covenant. But the promised land is, it's not just the land, you know, it's the whole, it's everything that's tied to that. It's that this is God fulfilling his promise. It's that this is his home, this is protection, this is provision, this is a foundation for great things. And the journey to get there, you know, signifies his care. It signifies, you know, don't forget in wealth what he provided in scarcity. All these things are tied up in the journey and the land. There's this literary term that you do not need to know, but I think this is a good idea to tie to this when he starts talking about Egypt and Assyria, is the idea of metonymy or synecdoche. And this isn't exactly that, but it sort of hints at that. But the idea of synecdoche is that this is like a literary term that means it's sort of reducing something to its most essential part. And so, like, to call somebody a suit or to talk about hired hands, you are reducing this person to, like, this one sort of signifying characteristic of them. But it means so much more. It's kind of this code word where you're not just talking about, like, the suit, but that means a lot. And so when he talks about Egypt, it's not just like a land of Egypt, but there's so much like historical baggage and emotional baggage tied to that. When that gets pulled into his discussion, it means a lot and it gives us a sort of punch. And just so she didn't, I don't think she talks about this in the study, but Memphis is the city in northern Egypt. And it was just south of the Delta, and there were all these huge graveyards there. And so when he talks about you're going to be buried in Memphis, that's why. It's because there were all these graveyards, and they were close to the pyramids, too. And I think that verse 6, like, there's such this, like, stabbing, cynical joking that is really terrible and really harsh. And there's, like, this total lack of sympathy that happens there where he is kind of laughing at them. And that is worse than even when, like, he's kind of upset. All right, and so let's push into the idea of sins remembered and forgotten. And this really touches back on the lesson last week, too. And there's a lot of, like, structural similarities between last week and this week. But in verse 9, he talks about that, I will remember their iniquity, I will punish their sin. And this, is, of course, is a flip from what we know in the New Testament. And we know when we kind of think of the Bible, because in Hebrews 8:12 it says, for I will be merciful towards their iniquities and I will remember their sins no more. In Hebrews 10:17, I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. In Isaiah 43:25, I am he who blots out your transgressions for my own sake, and I will not remember your sins. And then in Jeremiah 31:34, for I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. And so what Hosea is saying here, we definitely, thankfully, feel the reversal of that. Okay, and then the last kind of big thing that I want to talk about is that last reference, and it's just kind of this one-off little allusion that Hosea makes about Gibeah. And I don't know if y'all looked up, you know, in the study, she had you look up that story, and I'm not sure that everyone did, but we have this, like, contrast between the way that Gomer gets treated and then the way, this horrible way that the Levite's wife gets treated. And so basically the story is that you have this Levite who is a priest, and he has this concubine that he takes on as a wife, and he goes and visits her family, is hanging out with her family for, you know, days and days, and then they decide to leave to go back home, and they have to stop in Gibeah. And they can't find lodging there. And so they're sitting out sort of in like a town square or whatever. And this old man comes and says, you know, come in. You know, basically, this is not safe for you to be out here. Come into my house and stay. And so they come in. He closes the door, locks the door. And then the men of the town sort of rally and come pounding at the door saying, you know, let him out. Let us have this man so basically we can, like, rape him. And so the old man says, no, this is a horrible thing. Here, take the concubine, or take my virgin daughter, which, like, how do we even talk about this? And it's just the most, like, sordid story of the Old Testament. Like, I can't think of anything worse. And so what ends up happening is that they send the concubine out, and they rape her all night until she drags herself back to the doorstep. And we don't really know, but it says that when he goes out, he talks to her and she doesn't answer. So either she has died physically or she has died inside in every kind of way. He picks her up, puts her on his horse, takes her back home. Gets even worse. Chops her into 12 pieces and mails the pieces off to the different tribes. And so, like, what do you do with that? The only answer that I have is Gomer. Because we have these two former prostitutes who have married. And we have the way that the Levite treated his wife. versus the way that Hosea treats Gomer. And the Levite has left his wife to the mob. But Hosea does not do that with Gomer. You know, we know that he purchases her, he rescues her, he remarries her. And that, like, I don't have, that's all that I have to, like, salve this at all. And when we think through, you know, like, the treatment of the Levite's wife, it's totally revolting, it's totally dehumanizing. And what kind of man, like, what kind of cowardly man would ever do that? And not a man, you know, like, clearly a cockroach, like, nothing to hide in the shadows and let her go out and be his substitute. And it's totally shameful. And I do want to, like, push on it a little bit because it's there. But, like, do you think that he heard her screaming all night and just, like, sat on his bed or whatever and just listened to it? Do you think that, like, what do you think her, because it talks about him, like, talking to her father. What do you think her father thought when he heard what had happened here? Do you think that as she was dragging herself back to the door, do you think she was still hoping, like, maybe he will unlock it? Maybe he will let me in if I could just get back there? I don't know. Like, what did she think about his abandonment? And so she is abandoned by her husband, this priest, for his own self-preservation. And, but guys, I want you to feel it, that you are that man. You are the Levite. And that is Christ that went out to the mob and died so that you could be safe inside. That's you. That's me. That she saves him. And that is totally enlightening. Enlightening to put it next to Hosea and Gomer, but even more so to put it next to Christ and to feel that. That he is our totally redeemed, like, husband priest, and that he was thrown out to the mob to save us. And he is this upside down king, this sacrificial king instead of a cruel conquering king. And we praise God for that. That for the torture that he endured and the escape that it allows us. Amen.